Imagine a weapon with significantly more destructive power than a nuclear bomb of the same size, but without any radioactive fallout. Add the ability to scale these explosive devices from bullets to missile warheads capable of destroying entire cities, and you get what could truly be called the perfect weapon, one that any general or leader would desire. What if I told you that we already have a general idea of how such a weapon could be designed, and even a rough understanding of how to create it? I'm talking about so-called bombs based on nuclear isomers, such as the isomers of hafnium-178 or iridium-192. To understand the principle behind the operation of such bombs, that is, how exactly they should explode, we need to take a closer look at the phenomenon of nuclear isomerism and related concepts, which, as you may have guessed, will be the focus of our discussion today. To understand what nuclear isomers are, we first need to recall what we've discussed many times before, the structure of an atom. At the center of an atom is a small, massive, positively charged nucleus made up of protons and neutrons, with light, negatively charged electrons on its periphery. Electrons are bound to the nucleus by electrostatic attraction, and due to this connection, they can only exist in states with specific sets of characteristics, such as kinetic energy, momentum, angular momentum, and so on. We've detailed why this happens and why these electron characteristics in an atom can only take certain specific values in one of our previous videos. For now, it's important to remind ourselves that this is the case because there is an attractive force between the nucleus and the electrons. These sets of characteristic values are called energy levels and sublevels, and electrons in an atom tend to occupy the levels and sublevels with the lowest energy. However, it turns out that a certain number of electrons can occupy a given energy level. For example, the first energy level of any atom can hold no more than 2 electrons. Therefore, only hydrogen with 1 electron and helium with 2 electrons have a single energy level. Lithium, with 3 electrons, has 1 electron on the higher second energy level, which can hold up to 8 electrons, and sodium's 11th electron must occupy the 3rd energy level, and so on. However, the state of an atom where the electrons occupy the lowest possible available levels and sublevels is just one possible state. This is called the ground state of the atom. There can be another state. If we provide energy to the atom, equal to the difference in energy between some energy levels, the atom will absorb this energy, and this will result in one of its electrons moving to a higher energy level. This state is called an excited state. After spending some time in this state, the atom releases the absorbed energy, usually, but not always, in the form of a quantum of electromagnetic radiation, and returns to the ground state. These are quite basic details about the structure of atoms that are taught even in school and have been discussed many times on our channel. However, I felt it necessary to reiterate this because we will now talk about very similar processes, but this time within the nucleus. The nucleus of an atom, as mentioned earlier, consists of positively charged protons and neutrons with no electric charge. These particles, collectively known as nucleons, are also in a bound state, held together by certain forces. Unlike electrons, these forces are not electromagnetic, but rather the so-called strong nuclear interaction. To be precise, electrical forces are still present in the atomic nucleus, as positively charged protons repel each other electrically, which also affects the properties and stability of various nuclei. However, for our consideration, the attraction between nucleons due to nuclear forces is more significant. Considering the attraction between electrons and the atomic nucleus, we mentioned that the existence of this attraction causes electrons to distribute themselves in an atom across different energy levels according to specific rules, with electrons tending to occupy the lowest levels available to them. It logically follows that nucleons attracted to each other should behave similarly, distributing themselves across different energy levels within the nucleus in terms of the strong nuclear interaction. This is indeed what happens. Nucleons in the atomic nucleus also have energy levels and sublevels, although they are structured somewhat differently. We can extend this analogy further. We saw earlier that by providing an atom with a certain amount of energy, we can bring it to an excited state, causing one or more electrons to temporarily move to higher energy levels, from which they will subsequently return to the ground state, emitting energy. If the nucleons in the atomic nucleus are also distributed across certain energy levels, we can assume that by providing the nucleus with a specific amount of energy, we can obtain an excited state of the nucleus, in which one or more nucleons occupy higher energy levels instead of the lowest available ones. After some time, these nucleons will fall back to lower levels, emitting the energy difference between the excited and ground states, often as a quantum of electromagnetic radiation. While the energy released in the relaxation of electron shell excitations is typically a few electron volts, a unit used to measure very small amounts of energy in nuclear physics, and the corresponding electromagnetic radiation falls in the infrared, visible, or ultraviolet regions of the spectrum, the energy involved in nuclear excitations is in the millions of electron volts, resulting in the emission of hard gamma radiation. Gamma radiation almost always results from the emission of energy stored in the nucleus due to various nuclear transformations. For example, if a neutron is shot into the nucleus of a hydrogen atom, consisting of a single proton, a neutron capture will occur, producing a deuterium nucleus with one proton and one neutron. The mass of a proton is 1.07 atomic mass units, and the mass of a neutron is 1.009, summing up to 2.016, while the mass of the deuterium nucleus is 2.014, which is less than the sum of its components. The excess mass is converted into energy according to Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, and part of this energy is used to bring the deuterium nucleus into an excited state. The deuterium nucleus then returns to its ground state after a very short time, releasing the absorbed energy as a gamma quantum with an energy of 2.2 mega electron volts, or millions of electron volts. This nuclear reaction, incidentally, is actively used in practice in a process known as neutron gamma logging. A neutron source is lowered into a borehole drilled in rock. If the rock contains hydrogen atoms, these atoms will absorb neutrons and emit gamma quanta of a specific energy, frequency, and wavelength. By detecting this flow of quanta, one can determine the number of hydrogen atoms in the surrounding rock. Thus, it's possible to search for deposits of hydrogen-rich substances like water or oil. In most cases, nuclei remain in an excited state for minuscule fractions of a second. However, some atomic nuclei can stay excited longer, seconds, minutes, hours, and in rare cases, days or even years. Such relatively stable or metastable excited states are called nuclear isomers, denoted by adding the letter M to the name of the isotope's ground state. Some nuclear isomers are so stable they can be considered stable by human historical standards. One of the record holders is the tantalum-180Em isomer, theoretically having a half-life of about 70 trillion years, surpassing the age of the universe. Of course, we need to understand why the excited states of some atomic nuclei exist for such fleeting moments, while others can remain excited for so long. Formally, the answer is that in some nuclei, isomeric transitions, i.e. transitions from an excited to a ground state, are suppressed by spin and parity selection rules. However, this answer may not clarify much for my esteemed viewers. Unfortunately, to explain this in more detail, we would have to delve into nuclear physics and, in particular, the shell model of the nucleus far deeper than I planned. So let's simply remember that some nuclear isomers have significantly longer lifespans than others. Such long-lived isomers can essentially be very capacious energy storage devices, with the amount of energy stored comparable to that in the nuclei of radioactive substances. For example, the energy difference between the hafnium-178 isomer, hafnium-178M2, with a half-life of 31 years, and the ground status isotope is 2,446 kiloelectron volts, or approximately 2.5 million electron volts. By comparison, a single act of induced fission of uranium-235, used in modern nuclear power plants, releases about 200 million electron volts of energy. While uranium has a higher energy yield, the scales are comparable, and hafnium-178 can theoretically cycle between ground and excited states indefinitely. This means hafnium-178 could be used as a very capacious battery. 1 kilogram of this isotope can store over 1 million kilowatt hours of energy, enough to power a private home for at least a year. But this is only in theory. Practically, creating hafnium batteries comes with many challenges. It's unclear how to charge a hafnium battery, i.e., how to convert hafnium-178 into hafnium-178M2, and secondly, how to extract the stored energy for further use. Regarding the first point, theoretically it's straightforward. Irradiate regular hafnium-178 with a gamma quantum stream at 2,446 kiloelectron volts. Hafnium nuclei will absorb these gamma quanta, transitioning to an excited state, hafnium-178M2, and our nuclear isomer battery will charge. However, effectively generating gamma quanta of known energy, as we do with X-rays, is still beyond our capabilities. Another way to obtain hafnium-178M2 is through powerful neutron fluxes, similar to neutron logging technology. By bombarding hafnium-177 with neutrons, it captures the neutrons, transforming into hafnium-178. Part of the released energy is stored as nuclear excitation energy, including hafnium-178M2. We have powerful neutron fluxes in operating nuclear reactors, and theoretically, hafnium-178M2 can be produced from regular hafnium this way. However, production rates are minimal. In a reactor, only about 1 microgram of hafnium-178M2 is produced per kilogram of hafnium-177 annually, which also needs to be separated from hafnium-177 and regular hafnium-178. Increasing hafnium-178M2 production would require special reactors designed for this task, but why bother? Other simpler ways to store significant energy, like nuclear batteries or radioisotope generators, are ultimately easier and cheaper. It might seem we could close the topic of nuclear isomer energy on this pessimistic note, if not for another effect that caught military interest in hafnium-178M2. This involves the phenomenon known as stimulated emission, more familiar from electronic shell transitions in atoms. Here's the gist. An atom with an electron in a higher energy level, i.e., an excited state, will eventually release the stored energy as a photon. But this process can be artificially induced. If a photon identical to the one the atom is about to emit passes nearby, it triggers the atom to emit a photon, traveling in the same direction as the initiating photon. This is stimulated emission, the principle behind lasers, as detailed in another video. For nuclei in excited states, this should work similarly. If a photon with 2,446 kiloelectron volts passes by a hafnium-178M2 nucleus, the nucleus will immediately transition to the ground state, releasing another gamma photon of the same energy. In other words, a material containing many atoms of hafnium-178M2, exposed to a gamma quantum with 2,446 kiloelectron volts, would trigger an avalanche of gamma quanta emission, a violent energy release, or simply put, an explosion. Calculations show that the explosive power of a pure hafnium-178Mn2 piece would be about 3 times that of a weapons-grade plutonium-239 piece, making a hafnium bomb even more powerful than a nuclear one. This isn't its only advantage. Energy release from isomeric transition yields stable hafnium-178, meaning a hafnium bomb explosion wouldn't result in radioactive contamination. There would be an initial radiation burst, but post-explosion, the area and resources would remain radiation-free, ready for use. Another benefit, hafnium bombs can be of virtually any size without critical mass limitations. How about a 500-gram hafnium grenade with the explosive power of hundreds of kilograms of TNT? This indeed could and should work, but there are nuances. An atomic nucleus is tiny, and initiating its forced transition from an excited to a ground state requires a gamma quantum to pass very close. We can't precisely target individual nuclei, so detonating a hafnium bomb requires not just a gamma quantum source at 2,446 kiloelectron volts, but a very powerful one, a gamma laser, which we haven't yet developed. Even modern X-ray lasers are often massive structures kilometers long, let alone gamma lasers. So you can imagine the sensation caused by reports that isomeric transitions in hafnium-178M2 could be initiated by much simpler means. In 1999, American scientist Carl Collins from the University of Texas claimed to have triggered isomeric transitions in hafnium-178 isomer using X-ray photons at only 10,000 electron volts from a repurposed dental X-ray machine. The news caused a sensation. Most scientists claimed it was categorically impossible, as stimulated emission is triggered exclusively by photons of the same energy as the transition itself. However, the prospect of creating a hafnium bomb was so enticing that the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, immediately began investigating the effect supposedly discovered by Collins. The result, as expected, was zero. Even with significantly more powerful X-ray sources, the experiment couldn't be replicated, and the project was closed, costing American taxpayers several tens of millions of dollars. The first attempt at using hafnium was a failure, and this story tarnished the reputation of those seriously working on practical applications of nuclear isomerism. In principle, isomer nuclear technology could have peaceful applications, for instance, in creating photon engines for interstellar travel, as discussed in one of our previous videos. Indeed, photons carry momentum, gamma quanta carry relatively large momentum, and a large number of gamma quanta released in a short time during the isomeric transition of many hafnium-178 isomer atoms would create a thrust capable of accelerating a starship to near-light speeds. Thus, the theoretical potential of the technology is enormous, and humanity has repeatedly shown remarkable ingenuity in solving various practical problems. We can only hope that in this case, the results of applying this ingenuity will not be limited to creating new means of human destruction, but will also have more peaceful applications, like many other technologies originally developed for military purposes, but ultimately improving civilian life as well. And on this optimistic note, we'll wrap up for today. All the best, dear friends, and see you next time on our channel.